Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners. Good to speak to you again.
Letters from listeners.
Yes, and actually, we're going to extend that if it's okay with you and go back to more letters next week.
We get a lot of great letters, including sometimes handwritten letters, and it's fun from time to time to devote an entire program to the kind of listener mail we get.
And important, we were admonished a month or two ago for not doing enough of this.
Really?
Yeah, somebody said, you haven't done listener questions in a long time, and I wrote him back, said, sorry, we've been really busy, and he wrote back saying, well, work harder.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. So we
have the usual 8-minute digression on gardening at the beginning of the show.
It isn't quite that long, and it's important.
But it's great because
we haven't been admonished for garden talk ever since Pat Bartowski was on.
Well, because we brought in a professional.
That's right.
But you now your garden is planted.
It is.
You're completely in.
No, I'm waiting for a little bit warmer weather to put my tomatoes in. But I have about 70 or 80 tomato plants in my house, a number of which are going to you.
I need a few.
Yeah.
I have about 70 or 80 in my house.
So you really don't need it.
But I know you've got a couple of Jefferson tomatoes
I do.
I want.
Costaludo Genovese.
And how about your Joe Cockers?
Yeah. You gave me 6 seeds. And
I just like one plant. That's all
whoever saved those seeds didn't really do it correctly.
Uh-oh.
I got.
Are you listening, Western Colorado slope
country?
Well,
no, you know, you have to soak them. Tomatoes, the reason the seeds don't sprout is because they're coated in this goo in the inside of a tomato that keeps them from sprouting. Although, interestingly enough, if I may digress, there are some... Yeah, here I
think,
go.
Yeah, I think you will.
Yeah, there are certain types of tomatoes that are popping up in grocery stores that if you let them get a little too ripe, the seeds sprout and grow out. I posted a picture one. It's just weird.
So wait a minute. Now, the famous Joe Cocker tomato seeds
whoever saved them, not
preserved correctly
in your view.
No,
they just took them out, and you can still see the red tomato sauce on them.
So next year, friends in Western Colorado.
All we need is one.
Or you could still send it.
Just like your friend Russ Eagle. All we need is one plant.
And you demanded visible proof from Russ Eagle that the pea Robinson Crusoe experiment
has
worked.
Well, I didn't demand.
I think I heard you demanding it.
Anyway, so yes, I do have a Joe Cocker tomato. I think it's a, I want to say Polish pink or Polish heart.
It actually did sprout.
Yeah, I have 3 of them that are in pretty good shape.
You know, if I could have one, I would be thrilled. If not, I understand.
Count on it.
But and then you have the Genovese tomatoes from Monticello.
Mm-hmm. And we did a little seed giveaway a couple of years ago.
I remember when you would provide seeds to anyone who sent you a self-addressed stamped envelope.
Yeah, because I didn't want to go through having to, you know, get everybody's address correct. And dozens of people sent, and I pretty much wiped myself out.
And then you and our mutual friend Jim Fugley have the annual tomato festival.
Oh, and he gave away tomatoes at the birthday party.
He did?
Yeah, he had these. Oh, God, they're just gorgeous. I mean, I'm ashamed of my little things that I'm trying
to do. He's good at this.
Oh, he's great at it.
But then in the fall, he has this rule, Fugley's rule, that he eats tomato sandwiches until he gets canker sores, until the acid overwhelms his mouth.
So here's some of the questions that we answered this week. We started with one from Todd Garvey, who wrote us from Capitol Hill and wanted to know the origin of a story of Jefferson's many talents. One from Douglas, and you said his name better than me, Skazgleski, who wanted to know about the bust of Alexander Hamilton in Monticello.
And whether Wikipedia is basically sound, and I think, yes, it basically is.
I give money every year.
You actually give money?
I do, yes.
You're the rarest of creatures.
Oh, no.
That's fantastic.
What's his name? Jimmy?
And so they put on the appeal, and you answer it.
Yes, it was one of the thrills of my late son Webster's life. He got to meet Jimmy Wales.
No way.
Yeah.
So think of it, though. I mean, the Encyclopedia Britannica, which used to be the gold standard of encyclopedias, has like 43,000 articles. And Wikipedia has 4 million now.
Uh-huh.
So think of Diderot or Jefferson in the face of an encyclopedia that universal, that they would think, I can't believe such an entity even exists.
Another letter that was really fun and that I knew would respond to and you did not disappoint was this one from, I'll get his name.
The Invention of Air.
Jacob Edwards, yeah, wanting to do... recreate experiments and don't kill any mice.
Yeah, I think this is a question for Robin. I call her Robin the Magnifique.
We might have to get her back on. And the one from Scott Berry about this book, The Seed Underground, more garden stuff. So it was real fun.
A book by Janice Ray about the growing revolution to save stock.
I feel like we accomplished something this week for the listeners. We got to some questions, and I'm looking forward to next week and doing a few more.
My favorite subject is Jefferson and the Enlightenment. It's such a great subject to think that he lived in this time when people thought we can know everything, or if we can't know everything, we can certainly get well down the path. And when we know everything, life will get better for everybody. There was just such a period of optimism and rationality and hope. And of course, it's true. Today we can do brain surgery, in vitro surgeries. It's amazing what human scientific ingenuity has allowed us to understand and to manipulate. And they were just at the very beginnings of this, using really crude techniques and tools, and yet they solved the basic problems of the first set of basic problems of the universe.
It was a good show, and we hope you enjoy it.
Let's let people listen to it.
Here we go.
Here we go, folks.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. This week, seated across from me, is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the gentleman who portrays President Jefferson when he's here, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good to see you, sir.
Hello, the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. David Swenson. It's been a couple of weeks.
Well, not to the listeners, just to us.
To us, because I was actually ill. I get ill twice a year. I don't know what it was. But
I
had an ague, yes. I was not bathing my feet in cold water.
That'll do it.
And it came back to haunt me.
Well, I'm sorry for your suffering, and we were all worried about you. You seem fit and well now, sir.
You know, I have been out in my garden.
Yes.
And I know that some of our listeners have a limited tolerance for garden talk.
You know, we get less and less of that.
But they are wrong.
I think the show with Pat Brodowski sort of changed that dynamic.
So. Yeah. But I've been out there, and I'm taking a cue from Jefferson and a cue from you. So I'm trying to keep really careful records this year.
Really?
And so here's what I'm doing. I come from the Great Plains, so our style is to put our tomato shoots in cans, in gallon cans, for like coffee cans, so that the can serves as kind of a shield to the young plant. And so I managed to get about 100 of these cans, and they're gleaming and beautiful.
How did you get these cans?
I can neither confirm nor deny how. Okay. But I'm going to take a marker and literally number them from 1 to 50. So that can 1 will be tomato 1. And then in a notebook, I will say what the provenance of that tomato is.
It is beyond me how anyone can grow tomatoes and not keep track of what they, because of course, if they're not heirlooms, I guess it's.
But this one's tied to actual can numbers, so I can say can 22. I wonder why it's not flourishing. Let me look at my book, and then I'll discover what it was.
That's great.
And so this is a great
Jefferson time. Talked me into that years ago.
And my Jefferson great. Garden is, yeah. I got some topsoil for it, and I've worked that in. And yesterday, I planted 5 rows of Jefferson seeds that were provided to me by none other than the master gardener at Monticello, Pat Brodowski.
Yeah, we hope to talk to her again in a week or two and see how things are going down there.
But she said 2 things. She said that the spinach should be frozen first, which makes no sense to me, but the seed should be put in the freezer. And she said the corn, this was Mandan Hidatsa corn that I first got to her, and now she's sending back to me.
But Jefferson grew.
Yes, after Lewis and Clark brought those seeds back from the West. And she said soak the kernels in water on like paper towels until they sprout, until they germinate, and then you'll know which seeds are most likely to germinate. And plant only those. So that delays the Jefferson garden by just a little.
Well, I've the seed soaking thing, that's one I've...
You've done that.
I've done that. Beet seeds and stuff like that.
No, so Pat of Monticello doesn't have to purchase any seeds. I'm sure she does, but she doesn't have to because she saves seeds, as you do, and then she labels them in the Jeffersonian manner in small envelopes. And then the following year, she plants from the abundance of the seed supply that the previous garden gave to her. And so I'm not that good. My beans are up, my peas are up, my lettuce is up, my rhubarb is flourishing, but nothing else is up yet.
Well, I'm hoping that the weather holds, because if it does, I'm going to come fly over your garden this evening while you're working.
Now, you know, we have this mutual friend. We'll call him Jim.
Uh-huh.
And he's always gambling with the last frost. This weekend, he said, you know how he is. He's so bluff. He said, I'm planting my tomatoes. It's not going to freeze again. And, of course, you and I both know that here in North Dakota, it can freeze well into June. It doesn't very often, but whenever you say it ain't going to freeze again,
it does.
You're playing with what in the classical world was called hubris. Anyway, I wish him well. Now, you are more cautious. You're waiting on your tomatoes.
His lovely spouse had a birthday, and I was fortunate enough to be invited up there.
Oh, you were there.
And got to see his garden, and it's amazing. He is quite a garden.
She is a great gardener.
Whenever you try to compliment me and tell me that I'm a good gardener, I just think of Jim and know immediately that I am an amateur.
But they spend hours at this.
Yes.
I throw the seeds in and hope for the best.
To get off of this subject and save us before we lose everyone, you know, before the show we talked, you know, as we often do, about books and what's going on and this and that. And there was one that I brought up that I really, really recommend to listeners, and that's called, the title is Founding Gardeners by Andrea Wolf. And it talks so much about the gardening and the perspective of the gardeners then. And it's very interesting. You know, the first four presidents, after they retired, every one of them devoted their lives to agriculture. Jefferson finding that one magic plant that was going to change American society forever.
Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, if ever he had a chosen people whose breasts he has made his peculiar deposit. For substantial and genuine virtue, it is the focus by which he keeps alive that sacred fire which otherwise might disappear from the earth. That's as strong as anything that Jefferson ever said. Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God.
I walked you into that, and thank you
for
it.
But I mean, that's my favorite single Jefferson passage.
Might be, yeah.
So Andrea Wolf, if I could be anybody, I would be Andrea Wolf.
She's something.
Chasing Venus is her early book about the transit of Venus during Jefferson's time, which led Captain Cook to Tahiti, among other things. And then she wrote Founding Gardeners, which is this lovely romp through the place of the agrarian and especially vegetable gardening for all of the founders, even John Adams. And then she wrote Inventing Nature, this monumental book on the unsung hero of the Enlightenment, Alexander von Humboldt. And she's just, as you said, I think earlier, a young woman. Wait till she gets warmed up. I would give anything to have her talent and access. Amazing achievement. We need her on this program. So if any of you listening has a way of finding Andrea Wolf and asking her to be a guest on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we await that.
It would be terrific. We are separated by that magical thousands of miles of moat. I believe she lives in London.
She's in Britain, but I'm going to England this summer, so maybe I can catch up with her and we can have high tea at the Elgin Marbles.
And why are we here today? We are here today to serve our listeners and answer questions that they have sent to you and the president. I'm hoping you can pop in and out of character, perhaps.
Ooh, I don't do that very often.
Well, yeah, you do it well. You do it great. And we should start with one from Capitol Hill, Mr. Todd Garvey. You've got that in front of you, don't you?
The
subject
do, yes.
is Jefferson as a man of many talents. And by the way, we just did a show on that and his many talents.
Tie an artery, survey a field, try a cause, dance the minuet, play the violin. So here's this letter from Mr. Todd Garvey, and he says, I seem to recall a story, either from your show or elsewhere, of a group of travelers at a tavern. One had met a man on the road who, based on his knowledge, the traveler assumed was a farmer. Another traveler had met a man who, based on his knowledge, the traveler assumed was a philosopher. Another met a man he assumed was a scientist. A man he assumed was a gardener, etc., etc. I'd like to use the story in something I'm writing, and I'm trying to find the source of this story, as I think it is such a great reflection of Jefferson's wide-ranging expertise. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Well, the place that that story has been best told is by Andrew Burstein at the beginning of Ken Burns' documentary on Thomas Jefferson from 1998.
Oh, the one you're in.
I'm in it. I'm one of the talking heads. And
I think you're about 14 in that. You're just
exactly.
You're a child.
I was young. I needed the money. So that's he tells that story. I think the story comes from James Parton's early biography of Jefferson.
Mm.
It possibly apocryphal, but I will track it down. But there are two stories like this, David. One is that Jefferson, it's actually a single traveler, I believe, and the traveler asked Jefferson about farming, and Jefferson, he doesn't know it's Jefferson. It's just some other gentleman in the carriage. And Jefferson, of course, knows everything there is to know about it. And then the question is current science, and Jefferson knows everything. And so the traveler reports that this man is kind of a universal genius. He seemed to know everything. And then he's told, oh, well, that's Thomas Jefferson. That's President Thomas Jefferson. So that's one story. And as I say, it may be apocryphal. It's almost certainly exaggerated. But the sense is that no matter what subject you turn to, Jefferson is effectively the master of it.
You skipped the beginning of the letter, and I'm going back to it. He compliments the show and then says that he works on Capitol Hill, and he loves to start his day off with the calm reasoning of Jefferson before the chaos of Congress. And also, he says he keeps a copy of Becoming Jefferson's People, your book, in his office.
Oh, so, that's fantastic. I'm going to send him a copy of my Lewis book. The idea that someone who works on Capitol Hill would turn to Jefferson as
reassuring.
As a calming solace is wonderful. The other story is related to the first one, and that's that Jefferson was traveling incognito, as he often did. And I think he's president of the United States, and he meets somebody in a carriage who starts to abuse the president. And the man says that Jefferson is a Jacobin, and he's a free thinker and an atheist, and that he's an incendiary radical, and that his foreign policy is completely off-center. And anyway, goes into this long kind of systematic indictment of President Jefferson's activities. And the gentleman that he's talking to in the carriage nods and asks follow-up questions and maybe says, well, have you thought about this? But is completely incognito and harmonious. And then when they get out of the carriage at some stop or other, someone greets Thomas Jefferson, the president of the United States, and the poor man who was dumping all over Jefferson is totally humiliated and abashed and realizes that whatever else is true, Thomas Jefferson is a consummate gentleman and a very generous and civil human being. And he regrets that he assailed a myth, President Jefferson, when the actual real President Jefferson is one of the finest fellows he ever met.
That occurred a couple of times in Jefferson's life. Margaret Bayard Smith, right?
Yeah. So she met him. She thought he was going to be this, what we would call a Marxist incendiary terrorist, and he turns out to be this mild-mannered lover of flowers.
Great story. We need to take a short break, Clay. When we come back, I have a stack of letters, some very interesting questions for you, and we'll get to them when we return.
Good plan.
You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. This week, we're devoting the entire show to answering listener questions. Well, almost the entire show to answering listener questions.
But, you know, my essay this week is about the art of letter writing.
Oh, great.
And so, I we love the letters that we get from our listeners. Send more, please. And I particularly enjoy the ones that make me think about something that I've never thought about or are from some strange part of the world where you wouldn't expect there to be a Jefferson lover. Here's a letter from Todd Garvey of Capitol Hill with so much more to do every single day, and yet he turns to Jefferson as sort of a refuge of sanity at a time of almost unprecedented chaos. We love the letters that we get, and we read them all, and we try to attend to them too. Some of them are critical of you or me or both, and we read those with while blushing.
Yes. There's a number that make us blush, but I have an easy one here for me.
Oh, good.
Except for the guy's name, I'm going to give it my best shot. Douglas Szigelski?
Szigelski. It sounds Romanian to me, or Polish.
He has a simple question. He says that Carl Sagan, in one of his books, says that Thomas Jefferson had a bust of Alexander Hamilton in the vestibule of Monticello. Is that true?
That is true. So in the lobby, so the famous lobby, which is a kind of museum, you walk in, and today on the left-hand wall, you see artifacts of the Lewis and Clark expedition. They're recreations, but they're fabulous. They were done by North Dakotans, in fact. And then you see maps of South America, and there are elk antlers from Lewis and Clark, one of the few authenticated treasures of the Lewis and Clark expedition, etc. The famous calendar clock is there, and there's a wind vane on the interior of the ceiling, and so on. It's sort of a cabinet of curiosities. It's sort of Jefferson's introduction to anyone who happens to come to Monticello of who he is and what he stands for, a man of the Enlightenment and of deep and widespread curiosity. Well, there's a bust on the southeast corner of the entryway, and it's of Alexander Hamilton. And whenever I go to Monticello, and I've probably been 50 times, you get the tour and someone asks, "Oh, is that Hamilton?" And then the docent says, "Yes, Mr. Jefferson said that he liked to have his enemies close, or, you know, he liked to keep an eye on Mr. Hamilton." There's always some slightly weird explanation.
Yeah, that's
for
not
it.
Really true, though, is it?
No. I mean, Jefferson knew that Hamilton was a genius. He was what Jefferson would have called a natural aristocrat, that there are people who are so extraordinary that they force the world to pay attention to them. And Jefferson thought this form of genius was a kind of natural aristocracy as opposed to the pseudo-aristocracy in which societies just say this family is great or this person is important, that we would use the term meritocracy. So that he believed that Hamilton was an exemplar of extraordinary merit, and he recognized Hamilton's genius, that Hamilton created the fiscal stability which enabled the United States to pay its bills and to retrieve its credit in the world market and begin to prosper as an agricultural nation. Jefferson understood that Hamilton was really a very unusually gifted human being. He did think that Hamilton's gifts were misused, that Hamilton's vision was a bad one and one that would not bring about the happiness and the prosperity of the American people in the fullest sense. But that's another question. He admired Hamilton. He once said he's a host unto himself. He's a colossus of the anti-Republican forces. So it's not at all unusual that as he thought of the worthies of his day, Benjamin Franklin, James Madison, George Washington, Patrick Henry, Thomas Paine, that Hamilton would be numbered amongst them, John Adams. And so that if you think of any list of the top 10 founding fathers, Hamilton is inevitably on that list, no matter what you think of his vision of this country.
You use that word worthies, which was, I don't know if it's unique to that time.
They spoke that way.
Yeah, they did. From what I've read and from what you've taught me, there were a number of other busts of worthies that he had.
Jefferson was in France between 1784 and 1789, and he got to work with Udon, spelled H-O-U-D-O-N, the greatest sculptor of the Enlightenment. And he convinced Udon and Virginia to bring the famous French sculptor to the United States so that he could personally size up and measure George Washington so that Udon could go back to France and make this incredible bust of, not just bust, this statue of George Washington that still stands in the rotunda of the Virginia Capitol at Richmond. It's one of the greatest works of American art, one of the great monuments of the Enlightenment. So Jefferson himself was sculpted by Udon. He bought Lafayette's. In fact, he commissioned a Lafayette to give to the young veterans in France in thanks for Lafayette's work on behalf of the Revolution. And so he was well connected in these circles, and he got a Hamilton. That Hamilton has been in Monticello all of my lifetime. I don't know the story of where it's been and how it got back. But at any rate, it's not – Sagan is right in Demon Haunted World, page 427, that there is a bust of Hamilton there. The explanations for it always seem to me a little trite.
We have a letter from Keith Smith. I believe I have that one in front of you, and it's quoting an article in Wikipedia about – Jefferson and getting the Louisiana Purchase. Do you see that one?
Yes, I do. It's from Keith Smith, and it's, "Dear Mr. President and Mr. Swenson."
Swenson, he says. Okay.
"I was recently discussing a question of U.S.-French relations with a friend and turned to that great scholarly source of my time," I think that's sarcasm, Wikipedia. "When I was reviewing the article, I came across a line that seemed unbelievable. And the line is, quote, 'By 1800, Napoleon Bonaparte forced Spain to turn over Louisiana, which he envisioned as the base, along with Haiti, of a new world empire. President Jefferson could tolerate weak Spain but not powerful France in the West. He considered war to prevent French control of the Mississippi River. At first, though, Jefferson sent his close friend Monroe to France to buy as much land around New Orleans as he could. Surprisingly, Napoleon agreed to sell the entire territory because of an insuppressible slave rebellion in Saint-Domingue, modern-day Haiti, among other reasons. Bonaparte's North American plans collapsed. To keep Louisiana out of British hands in an approaching war, he sold it in April of 1803 to the United States for $15 million. The size of the United States was doubled without going to war." Absolutely accurate, 100%, as Wikipedia usually is.
Yeah, I'm a supporter of Wikipedia, and I wouldn't be sarcastic about it at all.
He says, "Is that accurate? Did Jefferson truly consider war with France over Louisiana?"
And he says that it came from a book by Thomas Fleming, a gentleman you know.
Right. I've met Thomas Fleming. Thomas Fleming has become a Jefferson critic in a way that I think is wrongheaded, but that's another question. But if that quotation is 100% accurate, did Jefferson consider war with France? No. But he did send a letter to Samuel DuPont, his friend, which was meant to be leaked to the French ministry, in which Jefferson said, "Look, when France takes possession of New Orleans, we must, quote, marry ourselves to the British fleet forever." In other words, if France reasserts a New World Empire and places citizens, colonists, troops in New Orleans, then that forces us into a rapprochement with Britain, and using the British Navy and the Anglo-British alliance, we will then have to be a counterweight to any designs that Napoleon's France has on the New World. So he didn't really think we were going to go to war with France, nor did he wish to. And he didn't rattle the saber, as he sometimes did with respect to Spain, but he did make clear that if the French occupied New Orleans, it would be a major provocation in the New World and would force the United States to be more friendly with Great Britain than otherwise we would be if France would just leave New Orleans alone.
He ends his letter by saying that he'd be the first in line to get a ticket if President Jefferson ever comes to Seattle.
I do come to Seattle.
Yeah, I thought you
had. And so I will look for him at the front of the line. I come there often. I love performing in Seattle, the readingest city in the United States.
Is it? I didn't know that.
You know, the thing about Seattle is that it's a great urban culture. It's sort of, how would you say it? It's Enlightenment blue, if that's a shade of color. But there are thousands of coffee houses in Seattle. It rains a lot. There's an urban emphasis on culture, beautiful museums, galleries, independent bookstores.
A great part of the world.
There are almost no places in North America that are as culturally satisfying as Seattle. And Seattle doesn't have New York's edge. New York's edge is magnificent, but Seattle's kind of a gentler version of American culture.
Our next letter comes from Jacob Edward, and it's the kind of letter that I think you could go on for days answering. It's made for you. You mentioned on a previous episode how the story of oxygen was discovered, how there were a specific set of tests, like using a candle in a container, and how the candle would go out if covered but would sustain itself longer if accompanied by a plant. And I know this is referring to discussions we've had in the past with both you and President Jefferson about Joseph Priestley. He goes on to say, I was wondering if you had any good historical references of the gradual buildup of scientific knowledge, what the details were of those initial experiments that paved the way for more experiments, and how the audience could replicate them if so they choose.
Well, this is a letter after my own heart, as you say, because I read these things and I think, well, how did Priestley do it? You know, you walk out of your house and there's air. We know that there's nitrogen and oxygen and helium and so on. But how did they know it? We take these things for granted. So somebody had to analyze, create a taxonomy of the elements that are in what we call air. And that was done using equipment so primitive by 21st century standards that you can hardly believe that it was possible. And so the famous story, which he points to, of how Joseph Priestley figured out that one of the constituents of air was oxygen, because when you burn a candle under a glass ball, the candle goes out, and yet all the air is still in. There's still as much air as there ever was in that vessel, but somehow the candle goes out. So whatever it was that was making the candle burn is gone or transformed into something else, and yet the molecular mass of the air is unchanged. So something happened, and so he starts that way, and then you puzzle. Well, I wonder what that was. So he did a series of experiments until he realized that there is something called oxygen. And that began the sort of cracking of the spectrum of air. This was done for clouds. This was done for chemical elements. This was done for library classification. This is the principle of the encyclopedia, that instead of having a book of knowledge, you have an alphabetically organized book of knowledge. The Enlightenment, like Jefferson, loved grids, charts, lists, taxonomies, classifications, reports. It was just that moment in human history that was so enamored of the idea that we can know things.
He goes on in his letter to talk about this fantasy he has of starting from square one and trying to sort of replicate some of these experiments, but he's not sure where he can find a list of procedures or instructions or anybody claiming to have attempted such an undertaking.
Well, this is a question for my friend Robin, the young genius I sometimes travel the West with, and this is exactly the sort of book she should write. But I'll tell you what, Jacob Edward, the first book to read is called The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America by one Stephen Johnson. And it is a really interesting account of Priestley's work, not only in the isolation of the elements in air, but also of his life as a free thinker, as the father of the Unitarian Church.
But he doesn't have to recreate the oxygen-deprived mouse experiment, right?
Well, I would say no mice were killed in this experiment, but but I certainly think, you know, did you remember this? We did a little of this in middle school where you would try these things. I would love for someone to walk our listeners and me through the basic scientific work of the Enlightenment. So take Ben Franklin and the kite. You know, it's a story every child in America learns.
Uh-huh.
Strangely, I don't know why that story should be the one, but Franklin reckoned that lightning was electricity. Nobody knew that at the time. But he reckoned that it was, and so he thought, well, how can I test this? If it's electricity, it should flow like electricity. I will put a kite up there, and it will discharge the electricity that's in the air and come down and make a key tingle or glow or something. And Franklin did it, a highly dangerous experiment. But when he saw that, he realized, oh, there's an application for this. This is why it's so American, because Franklin created the American Philosophical Society in 1743, the year of Jefferson's birth. It was dedicated, quote, to the pursuit of practical knowledge. And when Franklin realized this, he thought, I will put a piece of metal on top of a building, a church tower, and then a metal rod all the way to the ground. And so instead of lightning hitting the steeple and burning down the church, it will have the same effect of discharging the electricity from the storm harmlessly into the ground. And so he invents the lightning rod, which is one of the greatest inventions of the Enlightenment. It came from the same thinking. Ah, I wonder what that is, and I wonder how you understand what it is, and then I wonder how you apply it to human happiness. That's the very basis of all of this. And a book on this, I would love to read.
You know, I've always looked at that experiment as sort of a benchmark in human evolution history. It was a mark of man beginning to feel like he could conquer nature, because people were so terrified of lightning. It would kill you. And with Franklin's experiment and understanding of this, it was like, well, we can control this. We can do something. So I think it was significant from that point too.
Exactly, David. And so there is a famous epigram about this, about Franklin. I think it was by the French diplomat Turgot, but he said, I won't quote the Latin, but he said, Franklin plucked lightning from the sky and the scepter from kings.
All right.
So that the same thing is, you know, once humans get the confidence that they can know the universe, they also gain confidence that they can control the universe, including such things as runaway monarchies or political aristocracies or corruption in government. And so Franklin, this, what could be a better tribute to Franklin than that? He plucked lightning from the sky and scepters from kings.
Well, Jacob, I don't know if we've really answered your question, but I hope we have. And if you decide that you're going to
recreate, should write the book.
Yeah, we would very much like to hear from you, or perhaps we need to get Robin on
but
the show.
I'm gonna get the famous Robin on this and start her. But Jacob, do not burn down the barn.
She sort of strikes me as sort of a quiet type.
No, nothing quiet about her anymore. Well, we created a monster.
I've met her a couple of times.
No, she used to be quiet. Now she's assertive, and she knows more than all of us combined.
Will she be joining you in Montana this year?
That's my fear.
You'll have two people drowning you.
She'll be plucking lightning from the sky.
I don't know if we're going to make it through our entire stack of letters, but when we come back, there is a letter from Scott Berry about a book, The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food.
Oh, my.
Which I have obviously not had a chance to read, but I did.
You looked it up.
I looked it up and read the part of the preview of the book, and I took a look. It's very interesting.
I'm eager to hear it.
Yeah, and it's not anything new, this Seed Saver Society. As we both know, it goes back to the beginnings of this country and before that. So it's a very interesting subculture. We'll get to that letter when we return. Right now, we're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. I'm Clay Jenkinson, and sitting across from me in the New Enlightenment Radio Network barn is Mr. David Swenson, semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
We still get mail about that.
I don't know why people are so uptight about that.
You quit. Quit calling
and
me that.
And you begged for it.
Come on, man. It's a badge of honor. I want to be that.
Here's a letter from Mr. Scott Berry. Just listened to the Jefferson Garden episode with Pat Brodowski, and it reminded me of a book that means very much to me and that I thought worthy of recommending to each of you. If you haven't already discovered and read it, please get your eyes on The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food by Janice Ray. I'm not even an avid gardener or seed saver, and this is one of my favorite books for its insight, characters, and its manifesto message about seeds in our culture, kind of like The Jefferson Hour.
Oh, what a nice guy.
Well, I have not read this book. I'm, of course, ordering it. But I don't even want to tell you about my new self-discipline plan on books, David.
But you will.
I don't think so, because it's so shameful. But I am going to get this book. And, you know, it reminds me of the idea of food. You know, the idea of food is that you put one bean in the ground and it produces 20 beans, and then you save 18 of them, and you plant those 18, and it produces
20-fold. Did you have an experiment going with somebody?
With Russ, famous Russ Eagle of Carolina. And so I gave him, on a trip a few years ago, two, I think, I gave him a single pea from my garden, and I said, Russ, this is your pea. It is your job to be Robinson Crusoe. You must plant this pea.
Oh, such power you have over
and
people.
You must be a good husbandman, because you must make this pea produce. And when the pea produces, you mustn't eat the peas. You can eat one, but then you save all the rest of the peas and plant them. And then the next year you save most, if not all, of the peas and plant them. And at some point you'll be the pea king of Carolina. And he did it. This is a scene from Robinson Crusoe, and people who know this program know that there's a famous kind of fundamental classical scene about agriculture and human economy in Robinson Crusoe. He saves a bunch of stuff from the ship, and then he's messing around with this tiny little bag, and he pours it out, and there are a couple of seeds in it that he didn't expect to be there. He didn't know what would, if anything, would be in this little bag. And so he then realizes, oh my goodness, I'm a man alone on an island where there's no domesticated cereal of any sort. I suddenly have in front of me a few little seeds. If I can successfully plant them and make them produce what seeds produce, all my troubles will be over. But how do you get there from here? Because if that seed dies, end of story. And so you have to get through the first harvest when you're feeling extremely fretful. And then if you get abundance, you save most of the seeds over the winter and plant them in different plots in different places to protect them from varmints and weather. And then the seeds begin to accumulate. And at some point in Robinson Crusoe, he has more seeds than he can ever deal with. He's awash in flour. And this is one of the greatest stories in the history of the English novel. And it's a story about the miracle of agriculture, why, in Jefferson's view, all wealth comes from the soil.
I'm going to test your memory. Do you remember what year that was published?
Oh, Robinson Crusoe?
Uh-huh.
1760-some?
I can't remember.
No,
we've
too
talked.
Late.
I've asked you this before, but would it have been something that was around during Jefferson's time?
Yes, he knew it. He talks about it, and he writes a little bit about it.
Well, anyway, back to A Growing Revolution to Save Food by Janice Ray.
1719. I just looked it up on my smartphone.
What an age we live in. Reading just the beginning of it, it looks like a fairly interesting book. Some very interesting characters that are seed savers. And it really does tie into the founding fathers of that era of time because, I mean, that was – I want to say a subculture then, but it was really more than that. I mean, everybody got their seeds by saving them, and it was a big deal to share them. And how can I get this fabulous pecan tree? So there was a lot of that going on.
Well, seed sharing was extremely important. There's no internet. There are no catalogs. There are no ways to do this. You know, we take it for granted. In the spring, I go to Ace Hardware or even the grocery store and buy my garden seeds.
We take all our food for granted.
And so, you know, what if this garden that I'm just planting is the only seed base that I'll ever have, unless I can talk a friend into an exchange? But what if next year's crop depends entirely on my capacity to save seeds from this year's crop? Think of the pressure that puts people under. In Jefferson's time, there were no seed stores. He had some friends who had gardens and could provide some of this. But for the most part, if you didn't save seeds, you were out of luck. And so that's, again, why the famous passage in Robinson Crusoe is so important. And Russ Eagle's seed experiment has flourished.
I want photographic evidence of that.
Okay, Russ, you know,
send us a picture.
Quiet the skeptics here.
And Scott Berry comes from Virginia.
Midlothian.
Uh-huh. The heart, you know?
Of Midlothian. I've never been. I'd like to go. But I'm going to get this book, Growing Revolution to Save Food. You know, and I just read about something that really appalled me. It's called self-thinning seeds. Have you heard about this, David? So the GMOs, you know, you buy seeds that are already pre-fertilized. You buy seeds that have been genetically modified in the third world. You buy seeds that can't
proliferate. And now they're all
coated with chemicals.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you want to be careful not to be automatically against genetic manipulation. But what the GMOs are doing to maximize profits and to minimize human agricultural independence is truly crime, I think. It's like seed porn. And it appalls me to think that we are trying to monopolize the DNA of the seed stocks that could feed the world. And if there is now a seed where you plant X number of radishes or X number of barley, and there's something that allows them to self-thin, that fills me with alarm as a human being. It fills me with the deepest alarm, and I think that there should be an agrarian bill of rights, and I'm not joking.
Start putting that in our milk.
There should
or
be
water.
An agrarian bill of rights that requires people to be able to have access to seeds that have not been turned into profit-making monopolies by giant agricultural corporations that are more interested in profit than they are in feeding the people of the world. It seems to me that there is no greater crime than trying to delimit a seed's capacity to proliferate over generations.
Goodness, yeah. It does not seem right. We've mentioned this before, but the thing that strikes me and brings it back to Jefferson is his entire lifetime was involved in agriculture in some way or another. And my impression, even as an old man, he was continually searching for those new plants. And when we talked to Pat Bradowski, finding out that the gardens that we see when we visit Monticello—
They didn't feed anyone.
They were experimental.
They were all his experimental
gardens. You know, and a lot of failures. If you look at his garden book notes, failed.
He notes a lot of the failure in that great book edited by Peter Hatch. So Jefferson said, the greatest service a man can do for his country is to introduce a new plant species into its midst. And Jonathan Swift, the great Anglo-Irish satirist, said in Book 2 of Gulliver's Travels, "He who makes two blades of grass grow where one did hitherto has done more good than all of the statesmen of history." That's the spirit of it. So to our listeners, if you're interested in this, you have this book that we are talking about today, the new seed book. And give us the title again, David.
It is called A Growing Revolution to Save Food by Janice Ray.
You can read Andrea Wolf's Founding Gardeners. There is, of course, Michael Pollan's book, The
and
Botany of Desire.
Peter Hatch's book, which you just brought up, is just delightful.
So they're all terrific books about this very subject, but
I'm convinced more now than ever that you cannot understand not just Jefferson, but the founding generation, the founding fathers, unless you recognize how important gardening, agriculture, growing was to them, because it was a huge part of their lives and a metaphor for how they wrote the Constitution and the laws.
And if you haven't read Robinson Crusoe for a while, Daniel Defoe, 1719, one of the great books in the history of the novel and one of the great books in the history of the Enlightenment.
Clay, as usual, we have not finished answering all of the questions that we had in front of us this week. I propose we break protocol and let's answer some more next week. What do you say? Because there's one that's really important.
This one is handwritten. It's from a Jeffrey Butler of Greensboro, North Carolina. I have it in my hands. It's a beautiful handwritten 4-page letter.
And there's something very unique about handwritten letters.
Yeah, it's really great. And he says, I'm writing a letter of thanks and modest support. And he goes on to talk about how the Jefferson Hour has made a difference in his life over quite a long period of time and the continuing education in American history and politics that it has enabled Mr. Jeffrey Butler to have. And just coming in today and seeing this letter here in the barn was really moving to me. And so we thank people for writing us letters.
Me too. It's a bit long to read the entire letter on the show, but know, sir, that we both read it and we both appreciate it. And thank you so much for it.
And he likes the term semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. So there you have it.
Before we go to this week's essay, Clay, are there any announcements or things you want to share with your listeners?
Yes, in January at Locksaw Lodge, 2 retreats, one on Walden and Edward Abbey's great book, Desert Solitaire.
Oh, I must say that I think I saw something on the calendar back at the studio about a Walden session.
That's Walden, yes. Then your son and I,
just unbeknownst to me,
are going to record an audio version of Walden.
That's great.
Because people have a hard time with Thoreau, and I spent a lot of time trying to convince people that they should give him a second and third chance. And so I thought if I read Walden, I think I can emphasize the larger meaning of the text in a way that it's kind of hard to do when you read
you
silently.
You get a different perspective when you read
it
out loud.
So I'm going to try to push people through. So your son and I are working on that. And then the second one is on Shakespeare. Those are both January 2018. And this summer there are still a few seats left in a couple of canoes on the famous Wendover Lewis and Clark canoe trip / hiking trip, Great Falls, Montana, Missoula, Montana, and the Lolo Trail up in Idaho. And people who are interested in this, and believe me, this is the trip you must take if you're interested in taking a Jefferson Hour-related trip, they can go to jeffersonhour.com or my own website, clayjenkinson.com. They can find details, but there are still, I'm told, about 4 seats remaining for the annual Lewis and Clark cultural tour.
And if you'd like more information on the Lewis and Clark tour, or really any of Clay's upcoming cultural tours, go to jeffersonhour.com. You can find out everything you want to know there. You'll also find related information for each of the shows, copies of Clay's essays. And this week we've been answering listener questions. If you'd like to ask President Jefferson a question or Clay a question, you can do that at the website. There's also information about how you can support the show through the 1776 Club. And we'd be remiss if we didn't thank our listeners, those members of the club who choose to support the show. We really appreciate it.
It's great to have such loyal listeners, and we will reward you heavily with extra programming and so forth. And there will be at least parts of the audio version of Walden made available to 1776 Club members.
And with that, sir, it is now time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
David, the subject of this week's Jefferson Watch is why we should write letters. I love the idea that someone who did a very bad thing and now endures prolonged incarceration takes the time to listen to what we have to say and then sits down to write to us. Over the years, I've done my share of prison performances. They are always amazing experiences. I once touched off a prison riot, but that's another story for another time. My daughter asked me recently what I would like for Father's Day. I said, send me a handwritten letter in a stamped envelope. That's all I want. Her reply? Funny, Dad, but seriously, what do you want that can be ordered through Amazon.com? Okay, now we understand each other. My 85-year-old mother is selling the house I grew up in. With a little help from a friend, I cleaned out the attic not long ago. a classical, gloomy, moth-smelling, bat-infested attic with suitcases and trunks from another century. We took 4 giant loads of trash to the local landfill. That, too, is another story. But toward the end, I found a box of all or most of the letters I have ever sent to my parents from the time I graduated from high school until computers scattered all that we have to say to the labyrinth of cyberspace. I thought my parents had discarded those letters decades ago, but there they were, beautifully preserved, folded, neatly stacked in a nondescript box in chronological order. In my haste, I had nearly tossed them into the dumpster. I have only read 1 or 2 of them so far. My heart may not be tough enough to endure a full reading. And there, sometimes in my evolving handwriting, sometimes pounded out on my prized Hermes 3000 portable manual typewriter, is a record of my life, at least that portion of it I was willing to share with parents I trusted and admired. Jefferson said the only real record of his life would be found in his correspondence. He was one of the great letter writers of history. He chose his words carefully. His handwriting was so exquisite that it feels like artwork, like Sage of Monticello calligraphy. He lavished attention on his letters, sought maximum resonance and harmony with his thousands of correspondents, some of whom he never met, wrote carefully, thoughtfully, generously, with history in mind, and yet he never wrote self-consciously for posterity. Jefferson turned phrases better than any other American public figure except Abraham Lincoln. Imagine what it must have been to receive a letter from Thomas Jefferson, America's Leonardo da Vinci. In 22 years, I have written my daughter hundreds of letters. She has written dozens back to me. Someday, when I am safely scattered in the badlands of Dakota Territory alongside the sacred Little Missouri River, she will be cleaning out some space, closet, or storage locker, and she will find a box of my letters. Whether she will smile or shed a tear or flagellate herself for ever thinking Amazon.com can sell anything as valuable as one handwritten paragraph of love, I don't know. If you haven't written a real letter for a while, I urge you to do so. You will make somebody's day. And any Jeffersonian act in this distracted world is a small but important declaration of independence. Keep your letters coming to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. By the way, I'm betting I will get a Father's Day letter after all. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.